KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Santa Clara.
Santa Cruz.
Union City.
Hayward.
San Francisco.
I'm from Fremont.
Yo, I'm San Jose, just downtown.
Coming up, we'll head to the front lines in the battle against housing displacement, eviction court.
The consequences is for them is not, the numbers not adding up for the month in terms of what they've got from their properties. It's where are they going to go after this?
Then, rent control is up for debate again. We'll hear from both sides.
So there's the right of housing, and there is the right of ownership of property. Whose rights are more valuable?
What we've lost is the ability of the community to maintain overall affordability in the overall housing stock.
Strengthening rent control or shrinking it? Today on Cross Currents. Many of us are understandably consumed by the news at the national level. But the last election also came with major changes at the local level, especially for the region's ongoing housing crisis. On the local ballots last November, a lot of Bay Area cities pushed for new laws to protect tenants against the rising tide of expensive rent and displacement. Some cities adopted rent control and fair eviction ordinances for the first time. Others saw similar measures defeated. But tenant protection rules are only as strong as their enforcement. That's why courthouses are often the front lines in the battle between property rights and housing rights. KALW's housing reporter Liza Veal takes us there.
So if you're a tenant and you don't have an attorney and you're here for mediation,
48 households are up for eviction at the Hayward Courthouse this week. All heard today, Wednesday. This court is where renters from all of Alameda County come with their hopes of beating an eviction. The hallway is packed and tense with hours of anticipation. Lawyers haggle with each other. Defendants look through worn folders of paper. Tenant Vanessa Bulness stands elegantly in black, cooling herself with a painted fan. She's from the South.
Oh, yeah, North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina.
But she's lived in Oakland for 30 years. Her laugh is gone when she gets into her story. She and her husband were homeowners for 20 years until the foreclosure crisis.
And that's a whole nother story. I don't even want to get into that.
And for the last 4 years, they've rented a house that Bulness operated her childcare business out of. But long story short, she discovered there was lead in the soil where the kids played. So she lost her childcare license.
The agency refused to renew my contract to provide childcare services, which meant I lost my income. So, of course, if I don't have income, what? I can't pay my rent. So I can't pay my rent, and the next thing is eviction. So here we are today in eviction court.
Bulness hopes she can get the judge to give her some leeway by arguing that the property owner should have cleaned up the lead instead of ignoring her for almost 3 years. A lot of evictions are like this, not black and white. Both parties breached the lease in some way. Bulness says her property manager was in charge of 1,800 other units. It's a corporation that Bulness feels
is out of touch with communities. You know, they see us as dollar signs, I feel like. And so when situations like this arise, we're at their mercy.
Tenants like Bulness can feel helpless, but in Oakland and some other cities, there are protections in place for renters. For example, rules about what constitutes just cause for eviction. Plenty of tenants don't know the rules and just leave when they get the notice to evict. Bulness is fighting it in court, though, because she's got legal aid, an attorney working not pro bono, but low bono, as they call it. Lots of places are boosting their legal aid funding as displacement gets worse. San Francisco, for example, doubled its eviction defense budget last year. So today, there are a handful of these low bono lawyers here at the courthouse helping tenants navigate the law, working case after case all day. Tenants' rights advocates might say it's God's work, but not everyone would agree.
You could come in here today and say, hey, I didn't pay my rent because a dinosaur, you know, came through and destroyed the property. And somebody would help you in here to stall that out, make it so you didn't have to pay the landlord.
Jonathan Fleming is actually not an owner, but he's here on their behalf. He's a property manager for 200 units, all mom-and-pop landlords, a lot of local Oaklanders like him, he says. And he thinks some tenants exploit the court system to dodge lawful evictions. You know, find any little thing you can use against your landlord in court.
I call it the world of blackmail, pretty much, where it's just like, you know, you have a lot of people that come at you and they say, well, look, the tenant said that he saw something in the unit, so therefore he felt like he shouldn't have to pay his rent for the last 6 months.
Like the windows leak or the fridge light is out. He says that's what the lawyers are here for, to find,
you know, slick loopholes to help out people who, you know, sometimes don't need that help.
Fleming says if his landlords don't get their rent when they need it, they go to foreclosure.
You know, owning real estate investment property is not a welfare business.
And Fleming says if you're a landlord that treats it like it is, if you put other people's needs over your own profit, your business will fail. He says that over the years, as a property manager, he's lost 3 or 4 buildings this way. On the other hand, when I ask how many total evictions he's done, he says too many to count. Down the hall from Fleming, I meet legal aid attorney Joe Colangelo.
So I've got 20 cases, and I've actually got 2 motions on in the courtroom that I have to be in for before I can kind of come out and be around.
He's slammed, but when he gets a second, I ask him about what Fleming was saying. Colangelo says, yes, he doesn't enjoy going up against mom-and-pop landlords.
And I've had landlords cry, you know, and just plead with me, literally beg with me, and tell me, you know, I got a mortgage to pay, and, you know, they took it over from their parent who passed away, and they're just trying to keep it afloat, and, you know, they don't want to lose it.
But still, there's no contest in his mind when it comes to the stakes. He says landlords are entitled to fight for their businesses, and poor people are entitled to fight for their homes in their cities.
The consequences is for them is not, the numbers not adding up for the month in terms of what they'd got from their properties. It's where are they going to go after this? Ultimately, like, I'm dealing with someone who is telling me they have no place to go, and if they're forced to move in 2 weeks or a month, then they're going to be homeless.
Mom and pop landlords, like the ones Jonathan Fleming works for, they're out there. But the reality is, the majority of owners that Colangelo faces are corporations. Investment companies bought up huge swaths of low-rent housing in the East Bay after the foreclosure crisis, and they tend to evict more than mom and pops. Colangelo says even with increased help from lawyers like him, corporate real estate is winning the fight against poor people in the Bay Area.
The problem is big and it's growing. We are turning people away that need help, and it's only because we're limited by the resources we have.
Colangelo works for the Eviction Defense Center in Oakland. Their clients are all low income, and they're 85 or 90% Black and Latino. His clients, like all people in the area who aren't rich, often leave their city after an eviction because if you can barely afford the spot you locked down 10 years ago or even 1 year ago, you definitely can't afford the prices on the market right now. Colangelo believes that without organizations like his,
it would be a stampede of people of color leaving, and we're all that stands in the way. People just don't know their rights. I wouldn't even know my rights if I hadn't been doing this type of work.
Eviction's not a new phenomenon, but now that the Bay Area real estate market is so hot, it's happening a lot more in some neighborhoods. In cities with rent control, owners aren't allowed to hike rents much on current tenants. But if they get a vacancy, they can charge the next person as much as they'll pay. So there's a big cash reward if you can find a way to evict.
Every property manager is looking at their properties and thinking, everything around me is going up. You know, the place next to me was renting for $1,000, now it's renting for $2,000, and I'm stuck with, you know, this tenant who's kind of locked in at a lower deal. And so I'm finding that they are less likely to forgive like minor breaches, or they're looking for ways to just free up their units any way they can.
But some of the tactics owners use to do this are less legal than others. Some real estate companies have built their business models on buying buildings and finding savvy ways to evict. One way they do this is by exploiting the loopholes in the law that allow for no-fault evictions, like the Ellis Act. That's supposed to be for owners who want to sell their building and get out of the rental business. Another is the owner move-in rule, which is supposed to let owners or their family members move into the unit themselves. Colangelo says that one's on the rise.
The specific loophole to evict someone when they've been doing everything right, they've been paying the rent and abiding by the rules, they used to never see, and now we're seeing it 4 and 5 times a month in these different cities.
People and companies get away with exploiting eviction loopholes because rules that restrict landlords, they're like speed limits. There's nothing really stopping you but the fear of getting caught in court. So funding legal aid is like putting more cops on the highway to enforce the laws. There are ways to strengthen tenant protection laws at the state level that might stem the need for legal defense. But for the time being, the battles happen in the courthouse, eviction case by eviction case. In Hayward, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
Have you got a question about housing in the Bay Area that you'd like us to report on? Email us at housing@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Bava. We just heard that some advocates want to strengthen tenant protections at the state level. One way to do that would be to modify the Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act. That's a law that's been in place since 1995. What that law does is rein in rent control. Here's how. Rent control limits how much property owners can raise rents every year, right? Well, in California, thanks to Costa-Hawkins, those limits are lifted when a new tenant moves in. In that moment, rent can go up any amount. It's called vacancy decontrol. Then the rent control kicks back in and yearly increases are controlled from that new rent price. Got it? Well, as some cities adopt rent control for the first time, the ins and outs of rental regulation, including Costa-Hawkins, are all back up for debate. So we invited two people with different viewpoints into our studio to weigh in. Jay Kolekian directs the Berkeley Rent Stabilization Program. He's for repealing Costa-Hawkins. Krista Gulbranson directs the Berkeley Rental Housing Coalition, and she disagrees. KALW's Hanat Bava started by asking Krista what the problems with rent control are.
Well, I think one of the things that it does is it doesn't help the people you believe it to help. So let me sort of give you a visual example. You have a situation where you have a 4-unit building and you have 2 units that are exactly the same. In one unit, you have a guy who's been there for 10 years, and under rent control, his rent has been stabilized and only goes up about $150 a year. So 10 years later, he's paying about $1,000 a month. In that same frame, he's been able to increase his salary by moving forward in his career. Now he makes about $70,000 a year. So he's paying less than a quarter of his gross income on rent. Next door, same exact type of unit, single mother, nonprofit worker, makes $45,000 a year. She came into her unit a few years ago. She's paying $1,750 a month. So where in that does it help the person that really needs it the most when we talk about rent stabilization? It's unfair in that regards. And the reason for that is that rent control does not have a means testing component. So Section 8, for instance, does. You have to prove that you have a low enough income that you're in need of subsidized housing. And that's fair and that's right. In rent control, there is no means testing that tells us whether this person truly needs their rent to be stabilized or not. And so that single mom making $45,000 a year is now in essence subsidizing her next door neighbor who's lived there for 10 years at a much lower rent.
Mm-hmm. Jay, I see you shaking your head.
Yeah, there's a few points that I want to make. First of all, I've never met an owner who, there are many good owners who have good hearts. But I've never met an owner that will charge more for one unit because of what they're getting on another. They charge the market. That's what the current law, under vacancy decontrol, Costa-Hawkins, does. It allows when the first tenant leaves and a new tenant, a unit completely turns over, the owner's able to bring it up to any amount, really whatever the market can bear.
That sounds so like it would increase evictions.
It does. It provides an incentive to push people out. I would argue that a system other than Costa Hawkins was fairer. I agree with Krista. That change in state law makes things much more dysfunctional. What we've lost and what cities have lost, and we're really feeling it in Berkeley and I'd say the entire Bay Area, really throughout the state, is the ability of the community to maintain overall affordability in the rental units and in the overall housing stock. And we're able to do that in a strict rent control.
Mm-hmm. But do you see this likely changing at all, this law? You know, what are the political groups that tenants groups would have to fight to get this changed? Or do you see it even happening?
Well, I think there's a possibility of it happening. I think the last several years, the energy is very similar to what it was like between 1970 and 1980, or 1978 and 1980. In 1978, there were no rent control jurisdictions anywhere in the state. Housing costs were going up for tenants, for homeowners. Individuals who were in their home for many years were at risk of losing their home because of the property taxes increases. Something that they're on a fixed income, and they're not able to control the costs. And Prop 13 passed. All rent control really does is provide the same types of protections that a homeowner would have under Proposition 13.
Mm-hmm. Krista, you want to respond to this idea that this, you know, this is a time that's hearkening back to those times that Jay is talking about, and it's no wonder that 65% of voters in Richmond, for example, voted for rent control. And what's a good argument against that right now in these times, in this economic environment in the Bay Area?
Well, I think it's important to back it up a little bit. It's not just a direct argument against rent control. So I think you have to understand that the history of housing crisis issues in the United States and specifically in California, we've been playing this ping pong game between sides. So Jay speaks to Prop 13, which was an initial right to the property owner to reduce expenses. And then rent control was a direct response to that. So that was on the tenant side. So tenants got some rights through rent control because it applied rent control to all rental properties, no matter what they were. Then it's important to understand that Costa Hawkins was a direct response to the catastrophic results of that large applicability of rent control. So what we saw happen specifically in Berkeley was from about 1980 to the early 1990s, we saw this incredible ownership takeover in terms of owners feeling so constrained by rent control they couldn't afford to be in the business. They took over their properties to owner-occupy them. And Berkeley specifically saw a loss of 4,000 units at that time. And so who were the tenants that were exiting? Some of the statistics on that are Social Security recipients went down 7%. Single mothers went down 24%. Low-income people went down 11%. So they were the ones that were pushed out by the owners occupying the units because rent control was so strict. So Costa Hawkins was put into place to pull back some of that applicability and also to create vacancy decontrol, which, as Jay mentioned, is the event in which the tenant leaves and an owner has the right to set the rent to what they want. So in 1996, when Costa Hawkins was put into place, that was kind of the last time we sort of quote unquote reformed rent control by pulling that applicability back. And so here we are X number of years later, and the ping pong game continues. And so I think it's not so much a response of what's wrong with rent control is what needs to be modified yet again. What kind of reform do we need to have in public policy and housing policy specifically? And that's where we are today, and that's what we're seeing in some of these cases in cities.
What is this fundamentally about, Krista?
It's a philosophical one, I believe. It's sort of, at the end of the day, I think Jay mentioned it earlier, it's about what's just and fair. So it's what the question is, what's just and fair for the tenant versus what's just and fair for the homeowner?
And they can't be the same thing.
Unfortunately, the two truths cannot really coexist on some level. I think it's very difficult for them. And I think people fall on either side of it. And so what we have here, the philosophical argument is whose rights are more valuable. So there's the right of housing and there is the right of ownership of property. And at the end of the day, a lot of the proponents, certainly on the rent control side, are that they believe that the right to housing supersedes the right to private ownership.
Jay, you're nodding.
I agree with a tremendous amount of what Krista just said.
Mm-hmm.
People view this almost as a religious issue, and I do think there are solutions. If you take the hardcore ideology out of it,
strongly about it on both sides?
Right. Well, then, when people sit down and you take. And you can agree on some issues of general issues of fairness and your goals. Our goals are to keep people who are part of our community in our community. Our goals are to also make sure an owner does get a fair return.
When Jay speaks of knowing certain percentages of people that have been protected, the kinds of people that need to be protected through rent control, those are certainly in place. But there's the flip side of it, and that is that there's landlords that are very similar needs of protections, low income, seniors with fixed income. These are all people who own properties and do not have the ability to have the cash flow to take care of the building or to do right by their tenants. And so they suffer as much. So how can we protect sort of both of those classes from both the tenant and landlord side?
That was Jay Kalekian and Krista Gulbranson speaking with KALW's Hanat Baba. Just over a week ago, state legislators from San Francisco, Alameda, and Santa Monica proposed a bill that would repeal Costa-Hawkins and tighten rent control regulations for property owners. The bill's fate will be decided within the next 2 years. These segments are the first in our series about preserving affordable housing in the Bay Area. So much of the housing crisis debates are focused on new housing developments, where they'll go, how much affordable housing they'll include, how many we'd really have to build to bring prices down. But what can be done right now to help the people who already live here? Tomorrow, we're looking at the Section 8 voucher program and why a program that used to be successful is now failing.
You had one side of the aisle that liked it because it was providing housing to families, and on one side of the aisle, they supported it because property owners liked it. The world changes.
What will it take to reform the program and keep voucher holders in stable housing?
Everybody that I've known that I grew up with either are on drugs, living in another county or in another state. Because California is too rich for us poor people to be too poor.
That's tomorrow on Cross Currents from KALW News. Today's production team includes Hanat Baba, Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, James Rollins, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Kovalroop Singh, and Bowen Wang. The show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. You may recognize this song. It's Hey Hey Mama by Led Zeppelin. They're not in town for a gig, but a Bay Area Led Zeppelin tribute band is. Hey Hey Mama takes part in a benefit for ovarian cancer research at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco on Thursday night. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.